From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For 20 years, news organizations have increasingly acted as election campaign truth squads, vetting TV ads for the sort of vile misrepresentations that have so contaminated the political process. Some believe that such vigilance has chastened sleazy political consultants, at least in the arena of the 32nd spot, but electioneering has adjusted and is now far beyond a mere media buy. Pamphleteering, push polling, last-minute automated telephone barrages have simply moved the sleaze elsewhere, often below the radar of the truth squads. So now, to combat such guerrilla tactics, ABCNews.com is deputizing the electorate, asking readers and viewers to keep their eyes open for campaign excesses. Mark Halperin heads the political unit of ABC News. He joins us now. Mark, welcome to OTM.
Thank you so much, Bob.
You describe suspect political communications as messages that are false, logically flawed, racist or race-baiting, religion-baiting, sexist, class warfaring, or deeply personal. That's a lot of nasty stuff. What forms does it take?
It can be as low-tech as a flyer left on a windshield Sunday before the election, and as high-tech as internet emails or pop-up ads. The content, of course, is what matters, but these delivery systems are, whether they're low-tech or high-tech, very hard to track, even for a news organization that's willing to make the effort.
Now, you've covered a lot of election cycles, and you've seen plenty of sleaze, but there was one particularly egregious example from the past that inspired this whole watchdog program. Is that right?
In 1996, in the Republican primary in New Hampshire, Bob Dole, who had not done well in the Iowa caucuses, came into New Hampshire, critical, of course. People know the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary have a disproportionate influence on the process. Bob Dole's campaign was fading very fast in New Hampshire. Pat Buchanan, who ended up winining the primary, was doing quite well. And Lamar Alexander, the former governor of Tennessee, was also doing well. On the last weekend, the Dole campaign made some negative phone calls that were of questionable truthfulness about Lamar Alexander. Lamar Alexander is convinced to this day that if those calls hadn't been made, that he would have done very well in New Hampshire, had beaten Bob Dole. Bob Dole would have finished third, and many people think, and I agree, that Lamar Alexander would have probably gone on to been the Republican nominee had it not been for those calls. Those calls, people heard about them in the last weekend. They knew they were out there, but no one was able to pin down what was said, and the fact that the Dole campaign was the one making the calls, that was a case where I think the outcome really was affected by the press's inability or unwillingness to get on top of these calls, even on the last weekend.
So you're asking the electorate itself to do the media's work for it and to call these things to your attention.
Even major news organizations like ABC News or the New York Times that spend millions of dollars trying to cover the news, including elections, can't be everywhere. And campaigns that send messages that are in some way misleading or unfair don't go out of their way to let the media know they're happening. They go out of their way to do it in ways the media won't know. So we think the best way to track these things down are from citizens, because, of course, they're the targets of the campaigns. They are going to get these messages. And we want people, when they see them, to not just say, well, that seems unfair to me, or I don't understand that, or I know that's wrong, but to tell us about it so we can try to look at it and make a professional judgment about whether there's something misleading or improper about the message.
So how long have you been asking for this kind of material, and what have the deputies rounded up?
We've had it on the website now for about a month, and we've heard about automated phone calls that people have gotten that they think are questionable, and we've heard about some direct mail. What's important, though, is the coming month between now and the election, because most of these misleading messages, these negative messages, potentially racist or the other things you listed, come at the end of the campaign, because campaigns know that that's when voters are paying attention and where they're most likely to get away without anybody truth squatting.
I guess one of the advantages is not only to find the culprits, but just to heighten the electorate's awareness of some of the techniques that are being inflicted on them. Tell me about push polls, for example. Why should we, citizens of a democracy, fear a telephone pollster?
Push polls are calls that are disguised as polls. So someone will call up and ask you a series of questions, which they'll put in the guise of, you think, collecting information. In fact, what they're trying to do is spread information by asking leading questions, questions laden with negative information about the opponent or positive information about the person the calls are being made for, to try to send that message into the voter's brain, again, disguised as a poll.
What are you doing with this stuff once you collect it? How are you getting the news out to the public at large?
We don't obviously want to just take tips from people without trying to verify them and verifying them. We're asking people to, as much as they can, to collect these things. Email us or fax us the flyer or the email that they get, or in states where it's legal, record the telephone call. And then we do some reporting, old-fashioned reporting, trying to determine based on the information contained in the message of the person we think sent it, or try to figure out who sent it, call them, ask them if they stand by the message, ask them if they're affiliated with the campaign, and talk to the person who's the target of the campaign. Then we put them on abcnews.com in a daily publication we do called The Note.
Let's say this really takes off. It seems that it's inevitable that campaigns will start pulling quite elaborate dirty tricks with the aim of getting what is apparently nasty or unfair campaign material from one candidate in The Note to bring shame to him, when in fact it was generated by dirty tricksters from the opposing campaign.
Aha, we anticipated that possibility. And again, it's just going to require us doing reporting. We're not putting these things on abcnews.com unchecked out.
And not to be excessively cynical, because I believe you're doing God's work here. I also suspect that ultimately it will just have no effect whatsoever, and that you're going to invest a lot of time and resources trying to contribute to a more civil and honest political process, but ultimately to no effect whatsoever.
I tend to be someone who thinks you got to just do what you can do. And if we can prove to people that it's possible to fairly, quickly, accurately, and cheaply analyze political speech with the help of citizens, I think it's worth trying. And again, I don't see much of a downside, although I agree with you that this is a big problem and we're spitting in a giant ocean here. But I'd rather put some spit out there and see what happens than do nothing at all.
Very well. Mark Halperin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mark Halperin is political director of ABC News and co-author of The Note on abcnews.com.
Of all the niche publications out there, there's never been one designed explicitly and exclusively for the executive branch of the federal government. Until now. The brand spanking new Federal Paper promises to, quote, break new ground by providing behind-the-scenes insider news about the people, politics, and business of the executive branch. It's about time, I guess. After all, the military has Stars and Stripes and defense news, and Congress has Congressional Quarterly and Roll Call. Last week, the first issue of The Federal Paper rolled off the presses, and Tim Noah, who writes Slate.com's Chatterbox column, picked up a copy. He joins me now. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So, Tim, should we be cheering for the executive branch?
Well, I think that it's always great when there's a new newspaper or magazine that comes along that's going to cover the federal government in detail, as The Federal Paper clearly is. But I do think that there is this strange, vaguely troubling trend in publishing over the last 30 years, which has been that really the profit center in print journalism about government has tended to be newspapers and magazines that really cover the government like the trade press. It's kind of an insider phenomenon where you have newspapers and magazines that become a venue for one member of the government to talk to another member of the government.
And the reason why it's a profit center, I suppose, is because there's a great target demographic. I also have a copy of the first issue of the Federal Paper here, and flipping through the ads, there's one called Craft with Pride. The headline reads, "Can American soldiers depend on foreign factories?" And of course, the answer is no. There's another full-page ad from the National Education Association. In Pride of Place, the back cover is the Nuclear Energy Institute. These aren't places that usually would advertise in, say, The New Yorker.
Right. I don't buy products from these various advertisers too frequently as a private citizen. This has been what's driven this growth in the last 30 years. The National Journal was very early to spot this. And Roll Call, it really pushed forward this idea of using newspapers as an aggressive venue for getting issue-oriented advertising in front of opinion leaders. And it's been very successful financially. And it's also produced quite a lot of very good journalism. National Journal is a good magazine. Roll Call is a good magazine. This first issue of the Federal Paper looks to be very sort of useful and sprightly. It's always hard to tell from a first issue.
I don't know. I mean, when you talk about the National Journal, you're talking about really good analysis. And when you're talking about Roll Call, you're talking about cool, hot, up-to-the-minute gossip. When you look at the Federal Paper, you've got, you know, who's getting a new job and how much is this new building going to cost? I mean, this is pretty boring stuff.
I've certainly found things in this first issue that were of interest to me. I think my favorite detail in that first issue is that the new Office on Homeland Security may actually end up being headquartered at St. Elizabeth's, which is a nut house here in Washington, D.C.
See, that was former home of the great poet Ezra Pound.
Ezra Pound, and current home of John Hinckley. But their patient population has dwindled down to a few hundred, and so apparently they're sitting on a lot of land that may be of use to the federal government.
Tim, who do you think will read this paper? Is it the 30,000 people who work directly for the federal government?
They are targeting high-level government executives with free subscriptions. You know, people in government are voraciously hungry for information, and so are reporters like me, and so are lobbyists in Washington. So publications like this will always fill a niche. The cause for regret, though, is that there doesn't seem to be a corresponding hunger for this kind of information among ordinary citizens who, after all, are supposed to be the people in the driver's seat in a democracy. There's a certain level of boredom with what happens in Washington. It really translates into apathy about government, and I think that's a bad thing. And I think it would be terrific if we saw more of an effort by the press to try and translate what happens in Washington and in politics to the broader population. One thing that they've got in the Federal Paper that I think is kind of a neat innovation is they have a page that takes you agency by agency and tells you what happened the previous week at that agency. It's a fairly elementary thing to do, but I'm not really aware of any other publication that does it.
Tim, are you going to subscribe?
Am I going to subscribe? No, because they put me on the comp list.
Well, Tim Noah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tim Noah writes the Chatterbox column for Slate.com. And if you're interested in the Fed paper, you can check out its website, which is www.fedpaper.com.
Coming up, China fools with Google, selling innards on the net, and a novel way to write novels.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Censorship has been a part of internet life in China since the nation moved into cyberspace. China routinely blocks foreign news, pornography, and whatever is politically sensitive. In a nation where information lockdowns are the norm, restrictions like these might be expected. But internet users in China were outraged when the search engine Google was completely blocked for several days in early September. It was later restored, sort of. Harvard Law Professor Jonathan Zittrain, faculty co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, monitors internet access in countries like China. Since Google is the search engine of choice for many of China's roughly 45 million internet users, the uproar was no surprise. But soon after that, he says, things got a little strange in cyberspace.
After a few days of that uproar, one noticed when asking for Google, actually getting a different search engine back. So you would type in www.google.com, and you would get back the University of Peking's search engine for their university, or one of several other search engines tailored for Chinese users and perhaps not with the same political sensitivity that Google is thought to have. The next shoe to drop, so far as we can tell, was that access to Google was then restored, but then the behaviors became much more subtle, an almost Skinner-esque sort of conditioning technique, where innocuous searches on Google, you type in something like red hat, can return results as they normally would, but if one puts in a possibly politically sensitive phrase like Jiang Zemin, in the midst of that search, some of the results will start feeding back, and then as if the system is thinking better of it, only half the page of results will load, and from that, no more Google for you for about 20 minutes.
Now, does Beijing typically block search engines, or does Google pose a particular threat?
Of course, this is all speculation. But as best Ben and I can tell, Google may pose a particular problem for Chinese censors because it has this feature called cached page. Normally in the search results, you click on the result and you are then taken to the site in question that was returned as one of the results, and China could simply try to block those sites among the results it doesn't like. The cached page feature of Google, which many other search engines simply don't have, lets you see what Google saw in order to give that to you as a result to begin with. And in that case, you're getting the page as Google saw it, which is probably quite close to the page as it really is. And it may have been that which had the Chinese authorities thinking best to block all of Google because we want to block those cached pages so that they can't be used as an end run around visiting the sites themselves. Now what we're seeing is a more subtle form of filtering that may reflect an advance in the technologies that China is using to censor the net.
Well, this is part of what I don't understand. Why is China going through the trouble? There are Chinese search engines. Why not just block the foreign search engines altogether and require internet users to use their local search engines?
Well, that may really have been sort of plan A, exactly what we saw when one asked for Google and got back these other search engines. I think it may well be, however, that they're doing their best not to unduly make the internet less useful as an engine of economic progress, or just to unduly anger those who have quite quickly, within certain strata, at least in China, felt themselves pretty reliant on the internet. So the more that they can throw out bathwater but not baby, thanks to these more sophisticated tools, the more you'd expect them to do exactly that.
Of course, none of that really copes with the anger of the internet user in China.
Yes, and this may also explain why the blocking in China is as opaque as they can make it. And by that I mean, when one can't get to a site, one can't assume immediately it's because of some political decision by a censor. It just might be network traffic problems. In Saudi Arabia, by contrast, where there's also a state-run filtering regime, if you ask for a site that's off-limits, you actually get a message that says, sorry, this is off-limits, here's why, here's the policy, and here's a link you can follow if you think we've mistakenly categorized it to plead an appeal. It's possibly indicating that for the Saudis, it's more important for their government to make a show of filtering without necessarily having the regime have a lot of bite, where for the Chinese government, it may be exactly the opposite. They want to ruffle as few feathers as possible while still doing the filtering that's important to them.
So if you hit on something that's being blocked in China, you'll get an obfuscatory message like is currently unavailable or network traffic or link temporarily down, the sorts of things that anybody encountering a computer glitch might get. And
yes,
no sign of censorship?
And those are typically the messages that one's own computer conveys when the computer gives up waiting for whoever's on the other end of the connection who's supposed to respond when they don't respond.
What about all of those optimistic prognosticators that said once the internet got to these repressive regimes, the regimes would slowly collapse under the scrutiny of open society, of free communication? In other words, once you get the internet, the toothpaste starts leaving the tube and there isn't any way to get it back in.
Yes, what Jamie Boyle calls the so-called libertarian gotcha. I think a lot of libertarians touting that gotcha as a technical fact of life rather than something to be fought for are having a hangover. It may be worth noting that the United States now has seen its first instance of government-mandated blocking of sites by internet service providers. And what I'm talking about is the state of Pennsylvania, which passed a law last April entitling the Attorney General to designate certain destinations on the Internet as having child pornography on it. That pornography is not protected by the First Amendment in the first instance, and the Pennsylvania Attorney General can get a court order demanding that any Internet service provider serving Pennsylvania customers see to it that those customers can't get to those websites. And these are the very technologies in which China has the lead, in which perhaps our own Internet service providers in the United States may be asking for some help or reinventing some wheels, trying to effectuate the same sort of filtering here, just for very different reasons and for a very different kind of site.
Well, this was fascinating.
Well, good. Thank you.
Jonathan Zittrain is a Harvard Law professor and the faculty co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. If you're interested in seeing whether a given website is censored in China, you can find a link to the Berkman Center's real-time test page at our site at onthemedia.org.
The Internet has evolved not just as a medium, but also as a marketplace, most notably for books and consumer electronics, but also via such auction sites as eBay, damn near everything else. Among the merchandise bartered in cyberspace, human organs. According to University of California at Berkeley anthropologist Nancy Shepherd Hughes, who tracks the organ trade worldwide, it is a category of commerce that can thrive only on the Internet, even if it didn't begin there.
I was working in Brazil as a medical anthropologist, and I saw that there would be in the want ads little notices, like one from Manuel da Silva, who says, I'm a man in dire straits. I have a wife and four children, and I can't feed them. So I will sell, I remember so well the wording, I will sell any organ of which I have two, and the removal of which will not cause my immediate demise. This man probably had a letter writer, rather Victorian phrasing. And those kinds of ads really proliferated in many poor areas of the world. So people found their matches originally just by using these newspapers. How the Internet has helped is that a great deal of buying and selling and transplanting of organs combines the most incredible list of people. That is, you will have a buyer in Canada or the United States, a broker in Turkey, you may have a bank account in Italy or a bank account in Taiwan, and the patient who's going to provide the organ may be flying into another country from Nigeria. You will meet him, let's say, in South Africa to actually have this transplant. So it's just something that could not be done without fast communication through internet, through email, expediting this.
Is this really an internet issue any more than the proliferation of pornography is an internet issue? It's something that predated the internet.
Let me put it this way. Organ selling doesn't go back that far, I mean in time. The first evidence that people were buying and selling their organs is about 12 years ago. You know, in a way, the kidney selling has evolved with mass communication, with the internet. So they've kind of grown up together. And in terms of finding and locating the people to buy these kidneys, that's where the internet is very significant and important.
It's the convergence of the internet as a medium and the internet as a marketplace. And
right.
If technology has created the circumstances for this black market to exist, is there a technological solution for it? Can't these transactions be monitored somehow by groups like yours and by law enforcement?
Well, I do make the information I have available, yet I can't say that there's a great deal of energy going into trying to interrupt it. I reported to the Ministry of Health in the Philippines about a very, very interesting internet called Livers for You, you know, like toys for us. This is Livers for You. It basically says that if you have about $120,000, we will guarantee you a liver or a kidney, a little bit more, it says, if it's a living person, but we'll get you a cadaver liver or kidney if necessary, if you're willing to travel to Thailand or the Philippines. And they say that if, you know, you really want to look into how well-established our transplant centers are, they say call the American consulate in the Philippines, call the Catholic Church in the Philippines, or call the National Kidney Institute in Manila, and they will tell you that our transplant surgeons were trained primarily in the United States, and we're going to put you up in a 5-star hotel. So why wait for a morgue organ for 5 years when you can come here and in a matter of days we can get you the liver or the kidney that you want?
Call now, and we'll also give you a hypothalamus.
Right.
It's shocking.
So it is, and there just is a sense, I think, of despair in the transplant profession internationally about, from their perspective, the perpetual scarcity of organs that are needed and the fact that the waiting lists in the first world are growing. So that you'll have, at any one given point in the United States, as many as 70,000 people on one waiting list or another. And so I think they feel if people are willing to take the risk to involve in themselves in these deals, it's one less person that we have to deal with on a waiting list.
Dr. Shepherd Hughes, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Nancy Shepherd Hughes is an anthropologist at the University of California at Berkeley, and director of Organs Watch, an international group that monitors the sale of human organs.
Last year, there was a literary tempest in a teapot when British novelist Faye Weldon wrote a book called The Bulgari Connection after taking a hefty product placement fee from that famed Italian jewelry firm. She was widely condemned for turning her novel into a commercial. Well, multiply that indiscretion by 100 and you get Adam Lurie and Simon Gibson. The two advertising consultants turned authors have just launched Narration Limited, a fiction writing company which promises to produce a popular novel on the theme of your choice. Their first effort was a novel commissioned by a think tank about an anti-globalization activist who causes chaos on the internet. Adam and Simon, thanks for coming on the show.
And you, thanks.
Thank you.
So first off, describe your first project, Need to Know. The client was the Foreign Policy Center, which is the think tank patronized by Prime Minister Tony Blair. What were the sorts of issues that you were asked to bring forth in the novel and to dramatize?
Well, one of the things we were talking about in the book is the notion of open government, that on the one hand, most people think that open government is a good thing, that you know, we need freedom of information. But that may not always be the case in all circumstances. And so the book explores whether in certain circumstances secrecy is a good idea in diplomacy.
Simon, do you happen to have the book with you?
Embarrassingly, I'm afraid I do have a copy of the book with me. Okay, right. Something like this. Maybe Zhao's instincts as a journalist were failing him. Whatever the reason, Zhao had made a big mistake. Otherwise, he would have agreed to travel with the WHO team to their first field clinic, about 3 hours by jeep from Quito. It would have been an interesting drive, because about 2 hours into their trip, the WHO team took a wrong turn, got off their route, tried to retrace their steps, and drove straight into a minefield. The lead jeep was blown into the air, ripped and tossed and spat out. The driver lost both legs. Welcome to Angola.
So you have mayhem. Do you have murder and sex as well?
We couldn't quite squeeze that in on this particular version, no.
But we don't have murder, but we do have sexual intrigue. There are, you know, male and female characters, and there is a sexual tension between some of them, yeah.
Is The Need to Know a book that paints the portrait of a character who wants to cause havoc in pursuit of the anti-globalization movement? I mean, it does put anti-globalization in a pretty negative light, doesn't it?
I don't think so, no. I mean, I think we were very keen to make sure that if you were a committed anti-globalization activist, you could still feel that the character had integrity, had purpose. And what I'm hoping, and certainly the feedback that we've had from a number of readers, is that it's made a whole number of people say, well, just a minute, rather than actually just taking for granted when the government issue a particular statement, well, of course, they would say that, wouldn't they? You know, they're just protecting a vested interest. Maybe I'm beginning to understand some of the complexities that they're having to deal with.
I was just going to add that also the hero of the book is the anti-globalization protester. He, just like in Paradise Lost, he gets the best lines. He was a very powerful force in the book. So I don't think it can be levelled that we've sort of just done anti-globalisation down. That's certainly not the intent. The intent is to explore it.
Now, you've said you don't intend to be a propaganda tool, and you've also been quoted as saying that you'd be willing to rewrite if the customer wasn't satisfied. So how much control does the client have?
Well, I think the client has fundamentally complete control because she or he is paying for the venture. I think there's a big difference between propaganda, which is not even a debate, really. It's just a kind of one-sided story, and a fictional world, if you like, where having different characters allows you to present different points of view in different ways.
Yeah, and at the moment, much too much emphasis is placed on giving out the facts. A far better and more persuasive way of talking to people is through an imaginative construct, through a narrative, which allows them to make up their minds as they work through a story.
And that's exactly what critics like the writer J.G. Ballard seem to hate about what you're doing. This is a quote from him. "I'm all for the old style of public information stuff that told you how to stop your granny falling down the stairs, but when it gets to the point where you pick up what you think is going to be a successor to Anna Karenina and it has some sort of message about the dangers of sexual entanglement issued by a branch of the nanny state, that I think is sinister."
It's a wonderful piece of emotional ranting, isn't it?
I mean, it's kind of the literary establishment at its very best. They can't bear the fact that stories might be used for a straightforward purpose. We're not talking about high art here.
And one of the key points, I think, is that when the books are published, there is a logo on the front cover. Now, I think today's reader can understand that a book is produced by somebody with a particular point. You might argue that's even better and much more upfront than some of the more traditional polemic fiction. If you look at John le Carré's book, The Constant Gardener, which takes an extraordinarily vicious approach to the multinational pharmaceutical industry, it's a totally one-sided view of the issue.
But it is his own.
Absolutely.
You're certainly not arguing that books shouldn't be polemical and the full range of expression, however one-sided, shouldn't be present in books.
Absolutely not.
But that's in a sense, that's exactly my point, which is that if you are going to compete with people like John le Carré for people's hearts and minds, which is what you're doing if you're a major pharmaceutical company and you receive an attack like this, then I don't think you're going to effectively compete with them by responding with a whole series of kind of information fact sheets. Why not use the tools that John le Carré has used?
Can I ask you, is the pharmaceutical industry one of your prospective clients?
Not currently, no.
But you wouldn't mind.
We're talking to both business and governmental organizations.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Thank you.
Adam Lurie and Simon Gibson have launched Narration Limited, a fiction writing company which promises to produce the novel on an issue of your choice.
Coming up, in-person promotion at your local bar and a hero of broadcast journalism in the former Yugoslavia.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the decade of Slobodan Milosevic's bloody reign over Yugoslavia, the most penetrating voice of democracy in Serbia was not that of Western governments, nor of Milosevic's domestic opposition, but of a youth radio station called B92. For 10 years, the fearless group of young journalists defied government harassment, confiscation, and the very real threat of violence to broadcast, and when its transmitter was shut down, webcast news about genocide in Bosnia and Kosovo and criminal tyranny at home. Now in its 13th year, B92 faces a very different landscape. The student radio station has evolved into a multimedia enterprise, including a soon-to-be national TV channel and perhaps feature films.
Divine Julius Rogers, DJ, ili DJ Rogers, kako god hoćete, u pesmi Bula Jeans, sa kojim se zatvara njegova ploča It's Good to Be Alive, 75. godine.
It is the convergence of journalism, activism, commercialism, and no less than ever, paternalism. For instance, with Milosevic in The Hague on trial for war crimes, other Serbian stations stopped live coverage when they discovered it was making Milosevic a sympathetic figure. B92 alone runs the tribunal proceedings, which it regards as essential to the society's coming to grips with Serbian crimes. At the moment, Serbs are in the midst of choosing a president, either Miroslav Labus, closely tied to Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic, or sitting President Vojislav Koštunica, whose nationalist stripes are ever more evident. In covering this election, too, B92 has demonstrated its unique and journalistically unorthodox role in the reconstruction of the society. Last week, I visited B92's headquarters in central Belgrade and sat down with founder Veran Matic.
Veran, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks.
It's well documented what kind of force you were for journalistic freedom and for democracy up until this point. What's your vision for B92 moving forward?
During Milosevic, maybe it was easier because we only needed courage and imagination to overcome the obstacles. And now it's more complex situation because we have to be competitive. We have to develop entertainment programs. We have to become financially independent because we cannot count anymore on funding from the West.
Let me ask you about your progressive identity. Are you so associated with the Democrats, with Djindjic, for example, and now in the presidential race with Labus, that your journalistic distance is suspect? What do you have to do to make sure that you are not perceived for Djindjic and Labus as the equivalent of, for example, Radio Television Serbia for Milosevic?
During the last 10 years, during the Milosevic regime, we were heavily and very seriously criticized by the opposition parties. Why don't we behave like RTS behaves with Milosevic? We should be like that with the opposition. We should serve the opposition. But we succeeded in keeping our independent profile.
I hear a lot of whispers, sometimes more than whispers, that Djindjic has surrounded himself with his political cronies, and they are lining their pockets in the same way that Milosevic lined his pockets and taking care of themselves and enriching themselves now that they've attained power. Is there any evidence that that's true, and what is B92 doing to expose corruption within the current regime?
We have a series of shows coming up about the corruption, but the thing is that this society doesn't recognize corruption. It's so embedded in everyday life. It's normal to go to the doctor with a pocket full of money or in the countryside with a pig. So when you make a good story about corruption, they don't get it.
How often does someone come to you carrying a pig?
We gave clear signals that it's impossible to do that, so no one tried to influence. They put us in jail, they banned us, they threatened, but no one tried to corrupt us because they knew that if they tried, it would immediately appear on our broadcast.
I want to ask you about Šešelj. Vojislav Šešelj, as you know only too well, is a extreme right-wing, extreme nationalist, and a candidate for the presidency, among seven or eight others. I have seen coverage on B92 of President Koštunica, of Labus, and the other candidates, but I haven't seen a word about Šešelj. Why?
First, we think Šešelj is a fascist, and we don't want to use our station for fascist or racist ideas. Second, he doesn't have a real presence in political life. But if you put him in the media, then he gets a way to address people. He can gain some popularity. Our audience is still not politically educated enough to really judge by themselves or to differentiate fascist ideas from other ideas. That's one reason. The other reason is because 3 years ago we decided together with our other independent media to boycott Šešelj because he made a very severe accusation that we were responsible for the assassination of the Minister of Defense.
Isn't the suppression of any political voice, no matter how repugnant, itself an abrogation of journalistic principles?
We are in quite a complicated situation. We can decide to promote violent ideas which brought terrible horror to our country, or we can decide very consciously to restrict the ideas that have done so much harm. This country, its policy, even international community is not ready to deal with a lot of actors in this drama happening here that haven't been punished. Maybe it's not the role of a little station like B92 to educate people in these things. But since nobody else is doing it, we are.
I must tell you, I got a chill a moment ago, because whenever I hear a Serb say, "You don't understand, the situation is very complicated," I have to hold my breath for fear of what I'm going to hear next.
There are many things in this society that can give you a chill.
In this building, almost everybody will vote for Labas. 2 years ago, almost everybody in this building voted for Kostunica because he was, for a variety of complicated reasons, the right political figure at a certain moment in time. Is it possible that in the same way that Kostunica has outlived his democratic usefulness, that B92 has also outlived its democratic usefulness, or that that will happen sometime in the near future?
I'm absolutely sure that it won't happen. The progressive role of B92 will not be over because that's our identity. And if that goes, we won't be B92 anymore. We will still have an important social and cultural role. In the future, many people will try to misuse the media as an instrument of manipulation. And this is happening right now in these elections, and we must not permit that. We are trying to use the model of Channel 4 of Britain, which is like a public station, but with commercial role, like commercial PBS.
Which leads me to one final question. I notice I'm watching your evening news broadcast every night, and the young woman who is the anchor of the news never smiles. Why doesn't she smile?
I have to admit, I don't like it. I've noticed it, but I don't like it either. Though you have to understand under which kind of circumstances we work. And in this country, there are not too many things to smile about.
Very well. Veran Matic, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Veran Matic is founder of radio and now television B92. I spoke with him in his offices in Belgrade. There was a time when the 30-second TV spot could really move the dial for consumers. In marketing speak, that means make people buy things. But any ad man will tell you that the cost to make a TV spot is going up, while the number of people watching any given one is going way down. In the media-saturated 21st century, print, radio, even TV may be losing their power to sell.
So what's a marketer to do? Well, forget the media. OTM's Jad Abumrad takes a look at viral marketing, where the message is spread mouth to mouth.
The following is a dramatization. You're at your local dive, and you've managed to get a seat at the bar. Score. Things get better. An attractive woman taps you on the shoulder, hands you $5, and asks you to order her a drink.
Excuse me. Hi. Could you order me a veggie water with vodka?
Suddenly, the beer you're drinking seems so average.
Huh? What kind of drink is that?
I'll tell you a little secret. Veggie water makes a great cocktail mixer.
The two of you chat for a while. Nothing comes of this interaction, but you're feeling good about yourself. So the next day, you tell a friend about the attractive woman who bought this obscure drink. He asks what kind of drink. You tell him. He tells his mom, who tells her yoga instructor, and soon they're all trying it.
The exponential power of word of mouth is phenomenal.
This is just the sort of scenario that Jonathan Ressler specializes in. He's the CEO of Big Fat Promo Incorporated. Oh, I forgot to tell you, that attractive woman in real life is actually paid to be what Ressler calls a leaner.
They're aspirational but approachable, so they're not supermodels. They're just kind of people that look like they fit.
Leaners get their name because they're hired by companies like Big Fat to literally lean over the people sitting at the bar and strike up a conversation about a product. The goal, according to Jonathan, is to circumvent their traditional media ad glut and get the product in front of people when their advertising force field is down. Next step, turn those unsuspecting targets into unknowing evangelists for your product. And it doesn't just happen in bars.
You might come home and see a whole bunch of boxes from some online and catalog retailer sitting by the podium where your doorman is, you know, subconsciously thinking, boy, a lot of people are ordering from X.com. Now, you don't know that they're empty boxes that we paid the doorman to keep there.
A successful campaign produces that mystical substance, buzz. Something which 10, 15 years ago was thought to happen naturally, unexpectedly. Now it's carefully orchestrated through a series of usually covert product placements. But sometimes companies can't help themselves and brag about their in-person promotions. Vespa, for instance, revealed a campaign where they sent beautiful people to bars on scooters with the mission of getting as many phone numbers as possible. The next day, the beautiful people never called, but a Vespa dealer did. Needless to say, some people in the ad world are not pleased with this type of trickery. Ad commentator Kate Kay is one. She outlined her complaints in the 35-page missive, Sales Pitch Society.
The idea of people becoming essentially media buys on the same level as a billboard or a television spot in the mind of the advertiser is really upsetting.
Herein lies the debate. Does this type of in-person, often surreptitious advertising compromise personal relationships? Or does it actually give consumers a fighting chance?
I feel like it empowers the consumer. I do.
Amanda Kekkonen is the marketing and promotions director at a nightclub called Spa.
It gives the consumer an opportunity to push back.
Push back how?
Push back, like, ask questions.
But who knows to ask questions? Maybe people just want to have a quiet beer at the end of the day. And it's those type of moments that are being stolen from them. Shouldn't consumers be allowed to have a place where they won't be pitched?
It presupposes, actually, that we did have that place before, and we've lost it. And I don't know that our society was ever free from marketing in one form or another. Farmers used to paint advertisements on their hogs. Patent medicine companies would buy that space.
I guess that tells you that marketing is very adaptable. You can trace the modern roots of in-person promotion to Edward Bernays, the father of advertising. In the 1930s, at a time when it wasn't kosher for women to smoke in public, Bernays sent 1,000 debutante women to an Easter parade smoking Lucky Strikes.
And that one act in the press that was covered after that sort of changed America's smoking habits.
Sam Ewan, a Bernays admirer, is CEO of Interference Incorporated, an alternative marketing firm in New York City. He says that the new interest in so-called viral marketing is partly due to Generation Y. According to a study by the marketing research group ESOMAR, Generation Y is an ad man's paradox. While they're increasingly resistant to traditional TV ads, ironically, they don't mind being commercials themselves.
It used to be sort of a stigma to be a sellout. These days, when you look at commercials, the goal is to sell out.
Take Chris and Luke. the first college students in America to have their tuition sponsored by selling themselves as walking billboards for a major corporation. They spent a year looking for a buyer.
Luke and I had, we first made our announcement, and then, right off the bat, we did about 300 radio interviews searching for a sponsor.
This is Chris. Luke couldn't make it because of chemistry class. The two high school buddies eventually settled on First USA.
I have to say, myself, I don't know whether to be impressed or disturbed. And do you get that reaction a lot?
Not too often. The most people who get disturbed think we're just getting $40,000 for free and we're not doing anything.
In the case of Chris and Luke, the brand message is overt. They lecture at college campuses, spend 12-hour Saturdays doing radio interviews. They're just like celebrity spokespeople, only they're not celebrities. But Jonathan Ressler of Big Fat prefers his in-person advertisers to be undercover. The object is to slip in, plant the message, and slip out without arousing the slightest suspicion.
And by the way, it is everywhere. There's a lot of people doing it.
Really? Yeah. So this is more common than we realize.
For it to be effective, you never know what happened. So you don't know. I could be doing it to you right now. I could be.
Come to think of it, maybe he was. With ad budgets shrinking and TV commercial phobes turning to technology like TiVo for relief, what's left for the agencies to do except get reporters like me to do the heavy lifting for them? For On the Media, and God knows who else, this is Jad Abumrad.
If bar leaning is the marketing technique of the future, we wonder if it has caught the attention of CMG Worldwide, the Indianapolis-based licensing firm. Earlier this year, CMG was entrusted by the estate of Mohandas Gandhi to protect and market his image. Gandhi moved the world with his message of nonviolence. The question is, can he move merchandise?
Pardon me, young woman. I would be most honored if you would permit me to lean across you in order to reach my non-alcoholic cocktail.
No problem. Oh!
I'm sorry. I appear to have spilled my Rajmataj on your dress.
Rajmataj?
Yes, a delightful and surprising concoction of Darjeeling tea and Yoho brand chocolate-flavored drink. I find it to be indelicious. May I say you have supple skin?
Hey, Courtney, is this skinny dude bothering you? Hey, buddy, don't make me teach you a lesson.
You can torture me, you can beat me, but you can't beat the flavor of a Rajmataj cocktail.
That disgraceful exercise ends this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Natasha Kurgankar and Ulix Fekmu. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.